You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Today's broadcast is in memory of my mother, who taught me to read and was a lifelong reader. Coup of Hearts. When Prince Charles admitted an adulterous affair, royal watchers took Diana's side, calling Camilla Parker Bowles a homewrecker and worse. In an adaptation from her new book, The Duchess, Penny Junor shows how Camilla won over the Queen, the family, and the rest of Great Britain. This article is adapted from The Duchess, Camilla Parker Bowles, and the Love Affair That Rocked the Crown, to be published this month by Harper, an imprint of HarperCollins, copyright 2018 by the author. Opening photograph, Civil Service. Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles at their town hall union at Windsor Guildhall prior to their church ceremony the same day, April 9, 2005. When Sir Michael Peat arrived from Buckingham Palace in 2002 to take up the job as Prince Charles's private secretary, he came with a clear agenda. His instructions from the Queen were to sever Charles's relationship with Camilla Parker Bowles because it was a mess and was detracting from his work. This is certainly how the people in St. James's Palace who worked with Peat during those first months viewed the situation. Camilla had been the prince's mistress. He'd all but admitted to having an adulterous affair with her, and now she was sharing his bed, his house, and his life. And she was being seen in public by his side, but not as his wife. For a man who would one day lead the Church of England, this was an awkward situation at best. She had to go. It didn't take Peat long to realize that this was an impossible dream. The prince would never give up Camilla, no matter what. And so Peat rapidly changed tack and, with the zeal of the freshly converted, became the loudest, fiercest advocate for their marriage. While the prince's former deputy private secretary, Mark Bolland, had laid the groundwork for it, Michael Peat was the man who made it happen. But there were obstacles to overcome first. It needed not just the Queen's permission, but customarily that of the state, the church, and the great British public. The Prince of Wales really is the most curious character. In his usual way, he was dithering. On the one hand, he had stood his ground against his parents, the media, and the voice of the nation in making Camilla non-negotiable. A man who for decades had dedicated himself to duty, to doing the right thing, suddenly put everything he stood for and had worked for in jeopardy because of Camilla. On the other hand, this wasn't the first time he had needed to be persuaded to do the right thing by her. "I don't think the prince was happy with the way things were," says a former member of the team, "but he couldn't see a way of making it work. He'd been through a lot of bad times with the public, and I think he was probably nervous about putting himself back in a negative situation, damaging the monarchy, and he didn't know whether he could persuade the Queen to accept her. I think he thought all of these things insurmountable, and he really didn't know what to do. The prince is too diffident and nervous, and I think he was scared. Marriage was the only way their relationship and the prince's reputation would be able to move forward." Michael Peat went to the prince and told him very clearly that either Mrs. Parker Bowles must go or he must marry her. They could not, under any circumstances, go on as they were, and he gave Charles the confidence to believe it could be made to happen. Someone else who was key in persuading Charles was Camilla's father, Bruce Shand. He was then in his late 80s, and although he loved the prince dearly, he thought him weak, and was worried about how vulnerable he had made Camilla by allowing her to live in limbo. Bruce took him aside and said, "I want to meet my maker, knowing my daughter's all right." Charles adored Bruce. He loved the whole extended Shand family, and in turn they were very fond of him. But Bruce spoke for them all. They felt that Camilla's situation was precarious and a bit unfair. And although she herself had never wanted marriage in the past, things were different now. She felt herself to be neither one thing nor another, and was secretly grateful to her father for putting pressure on Charles. Having been at Buckingham Palace for nearly 15 years, where he had been close to the Queen, Michael Peat was the perfect person to put all the essential strands together and iron out the complications. He was well acquainted with the Queen's private secretary, Sir Robin Janvrin, and Janvrin, being sympathetic to the prince, was willing to offer helpful advice to the Queen. And although Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, had been the one to christen Diana the People's Princess, both Blair and Janvrin appreciated how important Camilla was to Charles. A stark contrast to Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin's reaction to Edward VIII's relationship with Wallace Simpson, for whom Edward abdicated the throne. The final component was the church, which then frowned upon second marriages if a spouse was still living, as in the case of Camilla's former husband, Andrew Parker Bowles. The solution was a civil ceremony with a church blessing. The staff at Clarence House, the royal residence lived in by the Queen Mother before Charles and Camilla moved in, felt that the greatest challenge was how a marriage would be received by the public. A populist poll had shown that 32% of respondents would be in favor and 29% against. 38% didn't care, while 2% had no opinion. As one palace advisor put it, they knew the media would be aggressive because it was like someone taking their ball away that they'd been playing around with in the back garden all that time. Colleen Harris, the prince's former press secretary, agrees. They'd all made a lot of money out of the story that Camilla was this evil, horrible person who ruined Diana's life and was ruining the children's lives, and they wanted that story to continue. The more we made Camilla acceptable, the less the story had traction. The idea was to make her more human, without making her more popular than him. We didn't want any of that rivalry again. To show she was a real person with real feelings and interest. Next photos, just married, Charles and Camilla in 1975, at the 2004 May Games, and at their religious service at St. George's Chapel, 2005. At Birk Hall, a 53,000-acre estate in Aberdeenshire, Scotland, over New Year's 2005, Charles asked Camilla to marry him. He had spoken to his mother, his sons, and the rest of the family when they were all together at Sandringham for Christmas, which Camilla had spent with her family. Robert Jobson broke the news of the engagement in the London Evening Standard, but it didn't spoil a thing. Clarence House was ready to go. They had a target date, but they knew the secret was unlikely to hold, and Paddy Harvison, the prince's communications secretary at the time, had devised a media plan covering every day for 3 weeks, just in case. And bless him, Robert Jobson broke it on the one day that was the best day of the whole 3 weeks, Harverson recalls. There was a charity ball that night at Windsor Castle. They were both going to be dressed up in their finest. It was a complete coincidence, perfect for us. Imagine if it had been a day when they weren't going to be out and about or seen together. The engagement was announced shortly before 8:30 on the morning of February 10, 2005, and within an hour the world's media had set up satellite trucks and cameras at Canada Gate in the mall opposite Buckingham Palace. Pundits roamed from one camera to another to be asked about their particular field of expertise. Most people seemed to be pleased and thought it about time. But not everyone. One woman I met outside Clarence House was so angry she had traveled across London to protest. "If Charles is going to marry that woman," she said, spitting out the words, "he should never be king." And some of the emails viewers had sent in to BBC Breakfast, the British equivalent of the Today Show, the next morning, were so terrible they couldn't be read aloud. "The adulterer should not be allowed to marry his whore," was one I happened to see. Julia Cleverdon, then the chief executive of one of the prince's charities, and the prince's great friend and sanest supporter in all things, was uncharacteristically in bed at home with a raging temperature when Elizabeth Buchanan, one of the prince's longest-serving private secretaries, rang and said, "Julia, I have arranged for you to be on the other side of the Windsor doors as they come through." Because Mrs. PB must be able to see somebody she knows in the flashing bulbs of the paparazzi. Julia pleaded a temperature of 102. "I don't mind if you've got a temperature of 106. Get to Windsor." So, after Charles and Camilla came through the doors the night of the ball, beset by flashing bulbs and a request to see the ring, Julia was behind them. "There were very funny pictures in Hello magazine," she says, "of me scarlet in the face." The ring, reportedly about $190,000 worth of platinum and diamonds at the time, had been a gift from the Queen. It was a 1930s Art Deco design, a central square-cut diamond with three smaller ones on either side, which had belonged to the Queen Mother and had been one of her favorites. When asked at the photo call how she felt, Camilla said she was just coming down to earth, but she coyly dodged the question of whether the prince had gotten down on one knee. The Prime Minister sent congratulations on behalf of the government. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh were very happy and had given the couple their warmest good wishes. The Archbishop of Canterbury was pleased they had taken this important step, and William and Harry reportedly were 100% behind the couple. "They were very happy for our father and Camilla, and we wish them all the luck in the future." The wedding was originally set for April 8th at Windsor Castle, and after a multitude of obstacles along the way, including a change of venue from the castle to the town hall, postponement for a day because the original date clashed with the funeral of Pope John Paul II in the Vatican, arguments about whether it was right or wrong for the country, good or bad for the boys, what kind of service it should be, whether Camilla should be called HRH, the Duchess of Cornwall, or something more low-key, and what the Princess of Wales would have thought, it finally happened. And the sky didn't fall in. The couple had a civil ceremony at the Guildhall, Windsor's town hall, followed by a church blessing at St. George's Chapel and a reception at the castle. It was a nail-biting day. No one knew what the reaction of the crowd would be, what the media would say, or how the whole thing would go. There had never been a royal wedding like it, where a divorcee would go through a civil ceremony followed by a church service. It was high stakes, admits one of the courtiers involved. If anything didn't go right, it would have been seized upon. We'd had all that palaver about where they got married, the ceremony being moved, the Pope's funeral, the ski trip, and the famous Nick Witchell, "I can't bear that man," remark. Charles and his sons had been holidaying in Clusters just before the wedding and had posed for the annual photo call with the media, which none of them enjoys. The prince hadn't realized how sensitive the row of microphones in the snow in front of them were, and was clearly heard saying, "I hate doing this. I hate these people." After the BBC's royal correspondent asked the boys for their thoughts on the upcoming wedding, Charles muttered, "Bloody people, I can't bear that man. He's so awful. He really is." And his words were recorded for posterity. "I was in Windsor that day, one of 2,500 accredited members of the media from all over the world. When I arrived at 5:30 a.m. for my first interview, barriers were in place, but the high street was deserted except for one brave family who had camped outside the Guildhall overnight. I couldn't help thinking about the hundreds who had camped out for days." Before that first royal wedding, 24 years earlier, by 10 there were still only a handful of people, and with the ceremony at 12:30, I began to wonder whether the public's overwhelming reaction might be indifference. Half an hour later, it was a very different story. The street was suddenly a seething mass of humanity, chattering in excitement. There were a few boos to be heard when the royal car drove up, but the vast majority of spectators were there because they were delighted that Charles was finally marrying the woman they knew he had loved for over 30 years. They were not disappointed. It was the most glorious, happy day for everyone there, and the bride looked absolutely stunning. She had chosen two beautiful outfits, one for the civil ceremony, the other for the chapel, and both were sensational. Next photos, well-traveled. Charles and Camilla at Highgrove, 2006. At Balmoral Castle, 2010. Arriving at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland, 2015. And on a private estate in Scotland, 2015. In the weeks before the wedding, while Charles went skiing, Camilla and her sister took themselves off to India for some sunshine, pampering, and relaxation, and developed a taste for it. She has never had surgery or used Botox, but she did use an organic alternative, a face mask containing bee sting venom invented by beautician Deborah Mitchell. The novelist Kathy Lett once said of Camilla, "She immediately endeared herself to me by revealing how many well-meaning Americans had sent her contact details of their cosmetic surgeons, which only served to give her more laughter lines. We had a good laugh that day about women on the wrong side of 50 and how the best way to avoid wrinkles is to take off your glasses." When she took her vows, Camilla was 57, and whether it was the detox and mud therapy in Bangalore or the bee stings closer to home, her skin, which had previously looked a little dry and weathered, had a new and youthful glow, and her glasses were safely inside her handbag. Camilla was actually not well on the day of the wedding. All that week she had been at Ray Mill, the house in Wiltshire she had bought in 1995 after her divorce, suffering from sinusitis. Several friends had come to see her, and they had had girly evenings in their bathrobes while Lucia Santa Cruz, who had introduced her to Charles all those years ago, came to administer homemade chicken soup. "In Chile, everything is cured by chicken soup," she told her friend, and had made her eat it. She was terrified Camilla wasn't going to get to the wedding. She was really ill, stressed. On the day itself, it took four people to coax Camilla out of bed. She'd spent Friday night at Clarence's house with her sister, Annabelle, and her daughter, Laura. She still wasn't feeling well, but now it was nerves more than sinusitis that kept her under the covers. She was terrified. She literally couldn't get out of bed, says Santa Cruz. Camilla's dresser, Jackie Meekin, was there alongside Annabelle and Laura, as was a housemaid called Joy, but none of them could persuade her. Finally, her sister said, "Okay, that's all right. I'm going to do it for you. I'm going to get into your clothes." Only at that point did the bride-to-be get up. She looked endearingly frightened when she stepped out of the car with Charles and waved briefly before disappearing into the Guildhall at Windsor. But it was clear the crowd was on her side. Slowly, as the day wore on, she relaxed, reassured and supported, as always, by having her family around her. Her father was not in the best of health, but it was an important day for him, and he was determined to be there. He had put off going to see the doctor until after the wedding. When he finally did so, 4 days later, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He died 14 months later, but he had seen his daughter married, and that was what mattered to him. Conducted by Claire Williams, the Royal Borough of Windsor's Superintendent Registrar, the ceremony was an intimate gathering and entirely private. Just 28 people in all, family and very close friends, watched the couple take their vows and exchange rings made of Welsh gold. Tom Parker Bowles, her son, and Prince William were their witnesses. Andrew Parker Bowles was not present, but he had called to wish Camilla luck. The only other notable absentees were the groom's parents. According to the Queen's biographer Robert Hardman, her absence denoted her disapproval of the arrangements, not of the marriage. "I am sure that's true, but I can't help thinking it was rather sad for Charles." Camilla was now his wife, and technically the Princess of Wales, but for obvious reasons it had been made clear that she would be known as HRH the Duchess of Cornwall, and as such she went back to the castle with her husband for the religious ceremony in the chapel. The crowds booed in disappointment when they realized the couple were leaving without coming across and speaking to them. But she needed time to change her outfit. Camilla's private secretary, Amanda McManus, was one of the people lined up waiting for them. It was so sweet. As they came up the stairs, they were both crying, and that set all of us off. So we were all sobbing. It was just so touching, and I think that was the first time we said, "Hello, Your Royal Highness." It was a very powerful moment. Everyone had to slightly keep it together. The romantic side of the day apart, their marriage heralded a complete change in Camilla's life, and true to form, head in the sand, she had not wanted to think about it too carefully. For the prince, that day brought an end to his loneliness. Camilla already shared his private life, but not all of his public life, and it was on the long, grueling foreign tours that he missed her the most. Henceforward, she would be with him to share the travel, the fêting by his host, the wining and dining, the concerts and spectacles that were laid on for him, the beautiful views that he was always taken to see. He'd have Camilla to laugh with him at the absurdities and mishaps along the way, and to chat, have a drink, and unwind at the end of each day. She, on the other hand, was entering a whole new world. She had never been a great traveler. She can't sleep on trains, and she is terrified of flying. But her future would be one of almost non-stop travel, long haul and short haul, helicopters, trains, cars. There would be state visits, receptions, and formal dinners. There would be ceremonial events and religious ones, when she would have to be on parade with the Queen and the rest of the royal family, and charity work would take her all over the country. On all such occasions, she would have to dress and look and behave like a duchess. Immaculate hair, immaculate makeup, nails, outfits, and hats. She had already shifted up a gear in her wardrobe, and the outfits for her wedding, both by Antonia Robinson and Anna Valentine, were simply beautiful. But that was just the beginning. As she signed the register in the town hall, Camilla was signing away the rest of her life to obligation, duty, and hard work. It is only when you follow a member of the royal family around that you realized just how hard it is to do what they do, and to keep on doing it day after day. It is like being at a wedding that never comes to an end, where you have to smile, shake hands, remember people's names, make small talk with strangers, show an interest in cows and cheese, and stand on your feet when you are aching to sit down and your shoes are killing you. She was embarking on this at the age of 57, perhaps wishing she were still weeding her flower beds instead. But on that joyous day in Windsor, she was just happy to have gotten through it without anyone throwing an egg at her. The blessing ceremony in St. George's Chapel, which the Queen and Prince Philip did attend, was performed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and the Dean of Windsor, David Connor, and the congregation joined in the general confession from the Book of Common Prayer. We acknowledge and bewail our manifold sins and wickedness, which we, from time to time, most grievously have committed by thought, word, and deed against thy divine majesty, provoking most justly thy wrath and indignation against us. Afterward, the big doors of the chapel opened, and they came out into afternoon sunshine, bathed in smiles. Ian Jones, then a royal photographer for the Telegraph, who had been on many overseas trips with Charles and sensed the loneliness, was in a prime position in a media pen to see them emerge. She was wearing this wonderful Philip Treacy hat, and the two of them looked like the weight of the world had been lifted off their shoulders. She came down the steps and came up and chatted to the crowd, and she chatted to us. There was no formality. "Well done, ma'am. Congratulations. Thanks, Ian. Thank you, Arthur." This was Arthur Edwards, the son's veteran royal photographer. We were happy for them. He was happy. He just looked relieved and content that they were together at last. Charles gave a touching speech in which he thanked my dear mama for footing the bill and my darling Camilla, who has stood with me through thick and thin and whose precious optimism and humor have seen me through. But it was his mama's speech that was just perfect and laid to rest any lingering notion that she might still disapprove of their relationship. The Queen is passionate about horse racing, and the date coincided with the Grand National, in which she had a horse running. She began by saying she had two important announcements to make. The first was that Hedge Hunter had won the race at Aintree. The second was that at Windsor she was delighted to be welcoming her son and his bride to the winner's enclosure. "They have overcome Becher's Brook and the choir and all kinds of other terrible obstacles. They have come through, and I'm very proud and wish them well. My son is home and dry with the woman he loves." There was huge relief and not a little astonishment that both the crowds and, in the main, the media had been so positive. I think they saw two people in their 50s getting married, and why not? It's a love story, says one of the guests. Reportedly, the late Sir James Goldsmith said, "When a man marries his mistress, he creates a vacancy." That won't happen on Camilla's watch. She sees off anyone who shows the slightest designs on her husband. Some years ago, I was told by a close observer of the goings-on at court that Camilla didn't like women and was marginalizing them. I don't think that is true at all. On the contrary, she is hugely supportive of women, and many of the issues and charities she has chosen to put her name to are in support of women. But she is wary of women who toady to her husband, who flatter him and laugh before he has even made a joke. Charles is very susceptible to flattery, and a few such individuals have gone, "He's a very bad judge of character, and it is the siren tongues," says a person close to Camilla. "If someone's nice to him, he thinks they're wonderful, while she's very sharp on people." There's also a sense of slight unease when it's women who are prettier and cleverer. And talking the same language as him, which she doesn't do. She can be quite dismissive of them, and she's quite right. Before getting married, both Charles and Camilla were very fixed in their ways. Diana had discovered this about Charles when she married him 24 years earlier. Now, in his late 50s, he'd become even more entrenched in the lifestyle he had created for himself, and Camilla, too. Adjusting to life under one roof was difficult. Charles is obsessive about order and tidiness. Camilla has always been untidy. Her homes have always felt lived in, full of clutter, dogs, and stuff that children have dumped. His are like country house hotels, with not a photograph or a magazine out of place. He has never had to pick up so much as a dirty sock for himself. She has been chief cook and bottle washer for a family of four. He has always had household staff to look after his every need. She has had no more than a cleaning lady to help. He has always had a punishing work ethic. She was new to the concept and found it hard to keep up. He likes people around him all the time and is a wonderful host. She needs a break from people and enjoys her own company and will often announce she's off to bed. He never eats lunch. She needs to keep her blood sugar levels up. He can succumb to dark lows. She is almost always buoyant. He has a terrible temper and can be moody and difficult. She can get angry, but she is generally very easygoing and cheerful. Inevitably, 13 years as a Royal Highness has changed Camilla, but not fundamentally. Her saviors have been her family, who keep her feet on the ground, a couple of good friends, who are prepared to tell her she's talking nonsense, and Ray Mill, which she kept when she married Charles. She has an escape. She can forget she is a duchess. She can go and be a mum and a grandmother, a sister and an aunt. She can put on old clothes, forget the makeup, ignore the hair, putter about in the garden, watch mindless television, cook everyone some lunch, and be untidy in her own home without feeling that the prince is itching to send in the butler to straighten the magazine pile or take away the empty glasses. Camilla spends most weekends at Ray Mill, and usually Mondays too. Lara lives not far away, and after her twins, Gus and Louis, were born in December 2009, just before the death of her stepmother, Rose, giving Lara 3 children under 3 years of age, she was grateful for any help she could get. And Camilla loves being with them all. She will quite often have dinner with Charles at Highgrove, and if there is nothing on the agenda the next day, go home for the night afterward. It's not so much an escape from him. The prince sometimes goes and stays with her there, as from the baggage that comes with him. Besides, he is up working most nights until well after she'd like to be in bed and asleep. Anyone would change, says someone close. Everyone tells her, of course, that she's the most wonderful person in the world, so she believes she's the most wonderful person. She automatically is the center of attention, come what may. Going into a room, if Camilla's there, even my best friend in all the world would feel they ought to go to her. For more than 11 years now, it's been, "Where's my tea?" I think we'd all be affected by it. And she has power. People will see her as ruthless. I wouldn't be surprised about that. When she doesn't like something, she's got the power to get rid of it. Neither of them like people who disagree with them. That is the trouble. There was, indeed, a great danger in marrying Charles, or more particularly marrying into the royal family, which was that she would change, and the Camilla that all her family and friends so loved would be spoiled. I have watched people around members of the royal family for a long time now, and something very strange happens to them. They turn into sycophants. I have seen it again and again, and it is no surprise that so many of the family are selfish, petulant, and demanding. At any gathering, otherwise intelligent people hang on their every word, treat the most banal of small talk like pearls of wisdom. They bob and curtsy, they laugh too loud and too long at the weakest of jokes. Meanwhile, a team of people hover to rescue the royal personages, to move them on to the next eager group, to clear a pathway, to open doors, to blow their noses, to do whatever it takes to make their day go smoothly. It bears no relation to life as the rest of us know it. Perhaps the only people who remain unaffected are Camilla's family. They don't pander to the nonsense over bedtime or anything else. They are respectful, of course, but they are not overawed by who the Prince of Wales is, and they find the royal circus faintly ridiculous, as they do the fuss involved when he comes to stay. They treat him like any other friend of the family or brother-in-law, and he relaxes. I think he feels cozy with us, and I think there are few people he's ever felt cozy with, says one of them. It's very sweet. There's no doubt she has absolutely transformed his life. And the way they laugh, she'll have exaggerated something beyond belief, and he'll say, "Darling, don't be so ridiculous," and say to me, "Shall we cut that down by 55%? There's a lot of that going on, which is so nice. No doubt about it, they are happy together. He thinks she's absolutely wonderful. It makes a lot of us laugh. Oh, Camilla's an amazing traveler. She never used to be."
Thank you.
the devil to pay. When hedge fund golden boy Eddie Lampert married Sears to Kmart in 2005, many were skeptical. Now, with hundreds of stores closed and thousands thrown out of work, Lampert defends his strategies to William D. Cohen, who also tracks down the ringleader of the 2003 kidnapping that could have ended Lampert's life. Photographs by Nigel Perry. Opening photo, Eddie Lampert at home in Florida. Few people on Wall Street are as polarizing as Eddie Lampert, the billionaire majority shareholder of Sears and Kmart. His friends say he is reticent, while his critics find him aloof. His pals talk about his very high standards, while some observers say he is condescending, overly critical, and disengaged. Some people praise his determination and persistence, while others see only inexplicable stubbornness in sticking to failed ideas. His critics will say he's not really a team guy. "He is a team guy," insists Lampert's close friend David Tiger Williams, a well-known Wall Street trader. "The Eddie I know works incessantly because he's a figure-it-out guy." Williams believes that Lampert is a target for criticism because he is a very shy person and avoids the public eye. But Mark Cohen, who was CEO of Sears Canada from 2001 to 2004, and now is a professor at Columbia Business School, says that Lampert is the wizard behind the curtain, managing the business from Florida or Connecticut or aboard his yacht via teleconference, and taking from the company all he can. While admitting he runs the company primarily from Florida, Lampert counters that he has put a fortune of his own money into the business. Cohen responds that Lampert's money is collateralized against hard assets, of which Lampert will take control if the company defaults on the loans. A spokesperson for Lampert says that can happen only if Lampert is the highest bidder, and the purchase is approved by the bankruptcy court, generally speaking. Once a wunderkind, who at 25 established his own hedge fund, ESL, Lampert is 55 now and celebrating the silver anniversary of managing his own money and that of a few select billionaires, such as entertainment mogul David Geffen, Michael Dell, Thomas Tisch, and the Ziff publishing family. He has had legendary successes, such as his investment in AutoZone, the auto parts retailer, in which he made a profit of around $750 million, at least 20 times his investment, and AutoNation, the car dealership, from which he has made $1.5 billion, and in which he still owns a large stake. He has also made winners out of Honeywell, Saatchi & Saatchi, and Liz Claiborne, Incorporated. But today, those triumphs are largely obscured by his worst mistake, the 2005 merging of Sears, the iconic retailer whose doorstop mail-order catalog was once a fixture in nearly every American home, with the down-market Kmart chain, which he had brought out of bankruptcy in 2003. 12 years on, this blundering into retail has made him a poster boy for what some people think is wrong with Wall Street, and in particular hedge funds. Under his management, the number of Sears and Kmart stores nationwide has shrunk to 1,207 from 5,670 at its peak in the 2000s, and at least 200,000 Sears and Kmart employees have been thrown out of work. The pension fund for retired Sears employees is underfunded by around $1.6 billion, and both Lampert and Sears are being sued for investing employees' retirement money in Sears stock, when the top brass allegedly knew it was a terrible investment. Lampert's spokesperson responds, "ESL never encouraged anybody to invest in Sears Holdings stock. The associate stock purchase plan began in 2006. It was perceived to be an effective employee retention and incentive tool. In 2013, Lampert, who was chairman of the board, had himself named CEO of Sears Holdings, as the combined company is known. He's had a rough 4 years since then. The company has suffered some $10.4 billion in losses and a revenue decline of 47% to $22 billion. Those stores that remain open are often shabby, with minimal inventory and few customers. A year ago, the company admitted for the first time that there was some risk of its ability to continue as a going concern, a technical accounting term that sent shudders through the ranks of Sears employees, vendors, and creditors, because it is often a precursor to a bankruptcy filing. On July 20th, Lampert announced that Sears would allow its Kenmore Appliances, one of the store's most profitable brands, formerly sold exclusively in Kmart and Sears outlets, to be sold on Amazon. On his Sears blog, Lampert called it a game-changing agreement. But critics branded it as just the latest example of Lampert's selling off the company's assets in a desperate attempt to stave off the inevitable. We suspect this is a move to beautify the Kenmore brand for divestiture and help alleviate some pressure, temporarily, of Sears as a going concern, Bill Dreher, an analyst at Susquehanna International Group, wrote his clients. The vultures are circling, waiting for Lampert to throw in the towel so they can try to make money by buying Sears' discounted debt. But Lampert continues to claim that's not going to happen if he can help it. The spate of negative media coverage and the dire predictions of Wall Street investors might explain why Lampert, generally regarded as reclusive, agreed to sit with me for an interview in what his spokesperson calls his first one-on-one, first-person interview in several years, which I calculate to be 15. In May, Lampert did a short Q&A with Lauren Zumbach in the Chicago Tribune. His desire to keep an unusually low profile may have something to do with the fact that he was kidnapped in 2003 and held for ransom by four young men over a long weekend. Lampert's Greenwich estate fits the image of how you'd expect a billionaire hedge fund manager to live. Assessed at nearly $26 million, it consists of 6 acres on a spit of land that juts into Long Island Sound. The main house is around 10,000 square feet, with a lot of stone and glass. After I was buzzed through the security gate, a guard popped out of nowhere to usher me into a grand but sparsely furnished room facing Long Island Sound. On the walls hung a few large, expensive-looking fine art photographs. Suddenly, from a side door, Lampert emerged with two handlers from Teneo, the financial advisory and public relations firm who would monitor our conversation. Lampert looked fit, if a bit awkward, in a gray polo shirt buttoned to the top. He was shod in a pair of brand-new, pure platinum Nike Air Vapor Max Flyknit sneakers. He, his wife, Kinga, 43, and their three children spend most of their time in Florida, where the children go to school. He made the point to me that in Florida, anyway, he's not the least bit reclusive. "I'm out there like a normal person, and I really enjoy that," he says. Perhaps it's just coincidence that Florida, unlike Connecticut and New York, has no state income tax. He also has a home in Aspen. Lampert rarely visits Sears Holdings headquarters outside of Chicago, some say only once a year, for the annual board meeting. Lampert dismisses any criticism of his long-distance management style, saying he's a big believer in handing over power to his management team. There are cultures where people work from home, and they still get things done, he says. the ability to trust people, the ability to empower people, that's the model. Mark Cohen, for one, isn't having it. He's had a puppet board who have never pushed back in any way that anybody has ever seen. And why would they, he says. They're all hand-picked Eddie acolytes, and people have asked me for over a decade, how does he get away with this? It's a public company, and why isn't the board in action given the continued failure of the business? To which I say, the board is meaningless. There's no governance here whatsoever. Lampert's spokesperson responds that the board currently has 6 members who are deeply committed to the maximum of stockholder value. They are deeply informed and involved. Cohen points out that current Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has been a shareholder and a member of the board of directors of Sears Holdings from the day that the combined company was formed until becoming Treasury Secretary, so he spent 11 years at Eddie's side. With all of Trump's focus on jobs, job preservation, job creation, somebody ought to ask his Secretary of the Treasury what his involvement has been for 11 years in the destruction of well over 100,000 jobs at Sears. A spokesperson for Mnuchin declined to comment. Lampert is no stranger to the plight of hourly workers, struggling to make ends meet because he grew up as one. His early years were spent in Roslyn, New York, an affluent village on the north shore of Long Island. His father was a successful attorney, his mother a stay-at-home mom for him and his sister, Tracy, but when Lampert was 14, his father died of a heart attack. That was the end of camp, or going away to Europe like the other children, his mother told the Wall Street Journal in 1991. She went to work as a sales clerk at Saks Fifth Avenue in Garden City for the next 20 years. Eddie was very strong, trying to be the man of the family, she recalled. During summer vacations, he worked in a warehouse packing boxes. There were a lot of times, Lampert says, when my mother came home, and it's like, I'm going to lose my job. I don't know what we're going to do. We'll have to sell the house. At Yale, which Lampert attended with help from financial aid and student loans, he was the student who, at finals time, would move into the library and stay there. He was very, very serious about doing the work, says his friend Benjamin Bram, a founder of Watermill Trading. Lampert, Bram, and Steve Mnuchin, who was in the class behind the two of them, roomed together off campus. At Yale, Lampert made connections that would be important to his future. His membership in the elite secretive fraternity Skull and Bones opened to him a rarefied world inhabited by the likes of George W. Bush and Steven Schwarzman, now CEO of the Blackstone Group. The holy grail among this set was Goldman Sachs, then, as now, Wall Street's most prestigious firm. The summer after his junior year, Lampert got a highly coveted Goldman Sachs internship. It probably hadn't hurt his chances that Mnuchin's father, Robert, was one of the firm's senior partners, in charge of the equity division. After graduation, Lampert ended up in the risk arbitrage department at Goldman, reporting directly to Robert Freeman, the partner in charge of the firm's business of buying and selling stocks involved in takeover transactions. Eddie just had a drive and ambition amongst a group of pretty ambitious guys that I thought was unique, Freeman says. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern. daylight saving time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock. Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.